Sort of lean across the table. The revolution of technology, as Harold Wilson used to say. The white-coated revolution.
What does that mean, the white-coated revolution?
Well, this is, you know, science-based kind of orientation. It's a little spooky, but anyway. That government wasn't elected until 64, so Frank was general secretary. It was before 64. Okay. You know, so it was fun.
So you were having fun. So we've gone back and forth. We've done some things on you, and we are just talking about that. And then we also talked about the grievance procedure.
And I went through.
Which way do you want to go?
It's really your, depending on how you want to move it.
I don't care. If you want, since we are working on the grievance procedure stuff, if you're willing to comment on that.
Okay.
You understood the background of this was that starting last spring through the summer, there was discussion about trying to have the grievance procedure and the user's manual more in sync, and then as those discussions progressed, then there was a...
The notion that one should really be...
Then what would you propose to do a more radical, and so here was a first rough draft. Since I've done this, I've already gotten some feedback from Terry and Donna.
Yeah.
I have a meeting scheduled with Christine, but it'd be helpful to get your feedback on what does or doesn't make sense.
I don't have anything, you know, there are not any major issues with it. There are a whole series of nits and nats, so maybe the thing to do is just to go through it.
That'd be helpful.
Pick them up already.
Okay.
Starting at definitions, exclusion 1.1, I think you don't want to say without some constraint academic staff, because that sweeps in the extension staff who have their own procedure who are not covered by the FGP.
Okay.
So you might want to think about something like any Michigan State University faculty or academic staff member who is an employee appointed with titles including, and then list out the titles, and then that's the kind of operational definition of the relevant faculty and academic staff.
That's helpful.
There is an issue with the term of employee appointed, and one of the questions that will be raised is if I'm an adjunct faculty member in Unit X and I've been in return for X and Y, promised to do X and Y, and there's some issue and concern, am I an employee or not? I'm probably not getting any pay. And I don't, that's probably a question you've probably never addressed, but it does come up sometime historically. And the argument has been that, you know, you got to get the green paycheck to be an employee. So.
Well, that was the reason to put in some phrase about who's an employee, because we had some people who had
I think that's fine.
Titles but really weren't employees. I think a main group of those was sort of these research associates that, that might have a... and wanted to clarify that visiting were clearly included rather than having to look that up.
Yeah, that's fine. 1.2.
Can I kick in 1.1 for
a
second?
Yeah.
Next, the last line, not defined here as administrator.
Yeah, and I have made a note of that since you seemed enthusiastic to do that. And so I was wondering why that didn't appear, because it's difficult to figure out.
And we have, that's come up in a discussion with Terry and I and Donna and Christine, and there isn't sort of a resolution yet of what to go forward with, but as you know, there's been the issue about unit versus central administrators. There's been the issue of whether or not assistant associates or only head administrators.
Yeah.
Can a person grieve against the assistant chair, only against the chair?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on what you think you'd recommend there?
Well, I think you're going to find a challenge with language that deals with all that complexity. I think if you can get something, and it may in effect have to end up in the user's manual, that really talks about the effective locus of the decision. So on the assistant chair issue, if you have some complaint about course scheduling, which is contrary to practice and policy in the entity, my notion would be, well, the assistant chair is appointed by the chair of the department and is ultimately responsible to that person, even if the role has been delegated. So in that instance, the chair would be the respondent to the grievance. And
do you think that's probably always the case, that it never should be assistant or associate?
I think these are, if you look at, I mean, again, the mode of folks appointed in those roles are largely an administrator. decision on who serves in that capacity, so that the assumption is they're then responsible to, and one might argue they're an extension of the role and authority of the administrator.
There's some logic to me to that. The only problem, well, two problems I see. One is if it's really the assistant or if units like deans, colleges, deans continue to sort of create associate deans for HR or sort of thing, who really are sort of making these decisions, I wonder if it's wise to then just, if the person can only grieve the dean, well, that associate's going to be the one who's going to have to handle the problem because they're the one that really made the decision. So that was one question. And the other is, isn't everything sort of delegated down from, like, the provost, in effect? I mean, even deans on RPT decisions are making recommendations, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But if you look at the bylaws for academic governance, it talks about the role of deans and it talks about the role of chairs and directors.
Right.
And it's fairly strong language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point you're making is that if, in a particular case, you would examine the facts and circumstances, and if really the dean has delegated the authority to the associate dean for HR to make decisions, then that person should be the respondent. But you would need clear articulation by the dean, I don't think a dean really at the end of the day can do that.
Okay.
One can do it practically, but at the end of the day, you've got to stand.
It's their decision.
Their decision. Right. And I understand the associate's going to be a key player because they will have had the background and the knowledge. And,
well, that seems to be the growing trend.
Yeah, so whatever. It's a mess.
Do you have any thoughts about this issue about non-unit administrators, the people who, in the central functions like the Secretary of Academic Governance, the...
I would do the same thing. I would say that if there's a policy, practice, or procedure that's been violated, or that's the allegation, then the question, who has the effective role in making that decision? And to go back to your famous Secretary for Academic Governance case, the argument that really, and to be blunt, Jackie asked me about that, I said, you know, there's a bigger issue here, but fundamentally, what's being complained about is not your responsibility. So you can't be a respondent in a grievance because even if you agreed with the grievance, you can't do anything about it. You don't have the authority. So again, it seems to me that template would be a reasonable point of view.
To me, being a unit administrator shouldn't be the key. I mean, I think we have too many non-unit administrators that it would be a mistake to exempt all non-unit administrators.
Yeah, no, I would agree.
Okay.
I think then the question is the effective decision-making role. I think probably what that means is you have some elaboration in this user's manual, because I think it's going to be very, very hard to write up something that's intelligible in the
But that makes sense.
Itself.
I interrupted you. You were going to say something.
I was going on to 1.2. It seems to me as written, which I think is... either my myopic reading of it or is left out, is that people, it talks about decisions not to reappoint, promote, or tenure non-tenured faculty in the tenure system. If I'm a tenured associate professor and I'm denied promotion to the rank of full professor, I can file a grievance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read that language literally, it talks about only non-tenured faculty in the tenure system.
The old language is to not reappoint non-tenured faculty in the tenure system, and I threw in the other two words.
Yeah.
One of the broader questions, I think, is when you go back to the 71-72 procedure, okay, this is there. This language almost identically comes from that original document, that original interim document. It's even 1.2. I mean, and the broader question, I mean, the point you just makes sense. I get what you're saying. The broader question is, does this even need to stay in the grievance procedure? What effectively does it mean to state that the FGP doesn't preempt or replace the functioning of UCFT? What does that really mean? And And should what it really means be spelled out in more clarity?
Oh, that's good. I think, in fact, what it is meant, well, I think it meant two things historically.
Mm-hmm.
One, to be blunt about it, it was a sop to the tenure committee, because the argument about the the original procedure was the tenure committee should be the body that deals with all these matters.
Right, it was a compromise to get this
So it was
in.
A compromise to sort of get the procedure in. The other issue is to make it clear that there is a separate procedure for the dismissal of tenured faculty for cause, which is the responsibility of the tenure committee or a subgroup drawn from it, and that it's clear that in two respects, one should not preempt that role by the grievance procedure. And the other issue, which does occur occasionally, is the process moves ahead, the dismissal procedure moves ahead, and the provost invokes that procedure, and the faculty member alleges some violation, misinterpretation, or policy or practice, and files a grievance. And historically, the answer is, you have several bites at the apple, but they're all within the dismissal for cause procedure.
Mm-hmm.
You can make the case one kind or another that the rules and procedures haven't been followed, and so on. You can raise that with the provost, and if you wish, you can raise it in the formal hearing, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether the language is clear in that respect, but I think those are the two intents.
I mean, the language pretty much is I think it's word for word what it had been in 71.
And the only question I would have, if you simply drop that, then you have some of these questions dangling, and you then go up to 1-1 that says, may file a written grievance alleging violations that are established by an administrator, etc. Do people know that means that if I'm not reappointed, I can grieve, or if I'm not promoted, I'm aggrieved? So if you could add a sentence that said, such allegations include but are not limited to issues of reappointment, promotion, and tenure, that may be able to get you around the corner. But I just wonder whether the language is too general.
No, that's a very helpful way to go.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I take you to the sidebar to the?
That I wrote saying, this assumes the ADJB is deleted, I guess.
Right.
And which is an issue at play, but yet to be resolved.
Exactly, right? And so it's kind of just in the hold. I've had some conversations with Paulette about it, and the interaction of the two procedures, and
would that mean, as a practical matter, that someone who alleges violation of the university's anti-discrimination policy can have a hearing? Cannot have a hearing, but only have an investigation by a staff member who produces a report, who then does what? Shares that with the president, who makes a decision about whether any action should be considered by an administrator in the particular matter, or is the alternate mode is that the FGP becomes the hearing body on these matters if the report is not a basis for informal resolution?
The reason I pulled it aside is because I knew from last summer conversations with either Christine Moore or Paulette or both that they're in the process with the president of looking at this because ADJB has stopped being used.
Yeah.
And they haven't had hearings in years.
Yeah.
Two or three, I guess. But they've been doing these investigations.
Right.
And so there's been, I think, good cooperation between the FGO and that office in terms of handling these. But this current language doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not very clear. And if there aren't ADJB hearings, to state that doesn't make any sense.
No, I agree with all of that.
So therefore, the thought was to do something that's more meaningful. And I believe Paulette's having conversations with both the General Counsel Office and with the President's Office.
See, the interesting thing about the hearings, about the investigations, I guess you can get to that if you look at the implementation procedures of the anti-discrimination policy. But I think it's a stretch.
Uh-huh. So I don't know that there shouldn't be some reference in here to those investigations and how they would be used, and to I'd certainly agree with Paulette that the grievance panels aren't the appropriate place to do investigations of allegations of racial or whatever discrimination. Perhaps they should be just like what I think we'll end up doing about the research misconduct and other things, is saying that discipline imposed because of is clearly grievable.
Yeah. But the end point, which is ambiguous, is Christine Moore does a study, describes facts and circumstances, and makes some conclusions and implicitly some recommendations.
Right.
What does she do with that?
Right.
I don't know.
I think turns that back to the parties, and then a complainant could either, and if they don't do ADJB hearings, then the complainant could either go external to Michigan Department of Civil Rights, or they could file a grievance. An administrator would have to take care of it in terms of disciplinary policy.
Right. Now, some of your problems with the procedures, FGP versus ADJB, is that not only faculty are eligible to use ADJB. So you may have a student, you may have a staff member.
And I have nothing to say. I'm not looking to increase the FGP's coverage.
I just think it's a kind of
sort
of a mess in terms of the particularities.
Right, but if they're right, so they have to sort out what's going to happen there. But then this policy should be saying something that relates correctly to it.
Okay. So I had that noted in a margin.
Mm-hmm.
1.3. This is, you know, for whatever, it's just sort of language. If you look at the second sentence, it might be useful to have language that says, any formally filed grievance for which an administrative review is requested shall be held in abeyance. It's just maybe a little more felicitous in terms of language. It doesn't, for me, change the substance of it. But that's, you know,
yeah, thank you.
That's a here or there. Okay.
We got one on the bottom before you move on. There's been some discussion whether or not 1.5 should also be the provost.
Practically speaking, it makes some sense. On the other side of the coin, the provost can be a decision maker about which there can be complaints, concerns, and a grievance. And so the question then is it, do you essentially convert the appeal stage to a hearing stage and the matter goes to the president? Seems to me that there's some merit in that. Because clearly the general counsel and staff members are in an advisory role. The FGO administers the procedures. The UIIO is an entity or a person that has a procedure that produces reports and outcomes, which then go to an administrator who decides what action is taken, and that's grievable. The Focolio, I still have a doubt whether the person has any, as I worked on that procedure, the person doesn't have any decision-making authority.
Right.
So, you know.
Which might be of value in spelling it out,
yeah,
that they're not grievable.
Yeah.
But the provost clearly is making all these,
well, not all of them, but making
significant
decisions. Seems to me.
So to me, it seems wrong to make the provost not grievable, but some others have argued that it would.
It happens very, very infrequently. The only case I can think of is the famous the case brought by the folks in economics about the reassignment of John Hildebrand when the court sent him back to MSU.
That would be one.
May be others.
The pair of frequent filers named Louanna Simon on occasion, as well as yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know that it was meaningful in the sense of, I think they were sort of, you or she was added as kind of a...
Covering the water.
While I'm angry at the, at the chair and the dean, I'm going to throw Banks and Simon in the kid pot. But that came up as a question.
I would argue that I think then you'd either buy user's manual or something, you'd have to explain with them what the procedure would be, because you would essentially have a truncated procedure, because it doesn't make any sense for the provost to be the receiver of a hearing report in the case in which he's have responded to a grievance. The rest carrying over, which I guess is 1-6, seems reasonable. I'm not sure why one deleted the IRB board chairs. Because it seems to me that they are making decisions.
Good point. Chris, I wanted out of there because it doesn't, that isn't how they organize themselves anymore. So,
well, I mean, that's
so naming question. Something that doesn't exist.
And David Wright was chair. He was power uber alles. So
right, but now now that office operates completely differently, and they don't.
So if I, just as a matter of information, if I want to do a survey and have a protocol, and the and Euchris says this violates the rights of human subjects, someone sends me a letter telling me, you know, what I'm doing is wrong and I need to make these changes, and I say, I think that's plain wrong, that's not sustained by anything, who do I grieve?
My understanding is it's an internal only procedure, and unless you're disciplined because of it, you can grieve the discipline, but the decision itself is not grievable.
But if the discipline is that I can't do my survey, which affects my,
my understanding
professional
is
role and responsibilities.
My understanding is the argument is that those are internal, and the procedure ends with the IRB.
Unless you can appeal to Washington.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah,
but it does, but it's not meant to be grievable.
All right, that's fine. That would be. Creative activities have been deleted. I couldn't.
I'm sorry.
Because I didn't, I'm looking at the box.
Yeah, it's...
I didn't have the original document, so I couldn't figure out.
Yeah, this is part of the language in 1-7.
Why would you drop creative activities? Because there can be...
Actually, I have them in there. I just moved them.
Oh, okay.
If you read 1-6 as a sentence, it's creative activities are there.
Very good. That's fine.
It really moved. It's a,
it's a question of...
It, yeah.
The thing that I picked up was deleting, which says to me it disappeared.
I agree.
What you do is you moved it.
Yeah, it's an
okay.
Error.
That's fine. let us see. Well, we come down to 223, which is the question of the broad investigative powers and access agreement. And I don't know what the course of your discussion is, available to a grievant, if the definition that is, you know, you process the formal grievance, or to a potential grievant. And the concern is that what, you know, what degree of latitude is John Revett replacing the FOIA procedures?
Right, we don't want that. So,
and it seemed, for me, I would not have any, now there, your other colleagues may have problems with this language. I have no problem with it, but I think that would be a useful user's manual commentary that says the FGO shall in good faith request information that, in his or her judgment, believes will be helpful in seeking to resolve the agreement. It's not to replace general information requests or the freedom or an employee's right under the Freedom of Information Act of Michigan, etc., which simply says to folks, you know, I tried to get this information and I couldn't, and you know, if I send it to the FOIA office, there may be a whole bunch of stuff, they're going to charge me 20 cents a page, and I'll just go to my friend John Revett and say,
right.
I'm a potential grievant, so would you get this information for me?
It becomes a problem.
Yeah, so that's the only concern that I have about it.
Spelling out, noting something about not to replace FOIA is useful. It could be in here, it could be in the user manual.
Yeah.
The other language, when this was discussed with colleagues, was to add the phrase, in an appropriate fashion, shall be, which was trying to get at this issue about things might be redacted. But they weren't, Terry was not bothered by the notion of potential grievance.
But he thought, you do have in a form that protects privacy and confidentiality of third parties.
Okay.
I mean, it seems to me that's the basic issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that if I'm asking for letters of reference, I can't get the name of the reference writer and their university and so on.
Yeah.
It seems to me that's that.
But do you think maybe spelling out not to replace FOIA? But I mean, your point's well taken. I think we don't want to do that.
I think the question is, you know, does it go in the procedure? Does it go in the user's manual?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I wouldn't give people false expectation that, gee, if I'm potentially, I'm really angry, I'm a potential agreement, I'll go along and tell Rivette he's got to get these people to turn out the contents of all their files and so on.
Good point.
So,
by the way, we skipped over 2.1, and I just wanted to let you know, there was some discussion about taking all of the things that are in Appendix 1, 2, and 3 and rewording them in a clearer way and maybe referencing them back to this 2.1.2, which talks a little bit about the process, and then things are in the appendix, and the appendix is kind of lengthy. And
so the appendix would go, or would it stay?
At least coordinate with the appendix.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The only question I would have about informant is that mean they have to be resolved by a handshake, or
where are you now?
I'm on 2.2.1. You've inserted effort to informally resolve the grievance, and that was added, and which is a qualifier to resolve. So if you and I, you know, you're the FGO and I have want to pursue a grievance, and you talk with me and you talk with the respondent, and at the end we craft a letter of understanding. It's an exchange.
Right,
the person writes me a letter. It's part of the record. It goes to my personal file. I say, well, with that in hand, I'm not going to pursue a grievance anymore. Is that an informal resolution?
Yeah, it's not a hearing.
Well,
but do you think it should be spelled out to resolve without a hearing and or assure the hearings?
Perhaps that's a way of dealing with it. It's sort
okay.
of a, because well, I don't want to get into the argument of saying, well, gee, that looks pretty formal to me, and therefore Rivette is exceeding his authority. I mean, that's just foolishness.
No, my point in wanting something is much of the business is not about hearings.
Yeah. So I think
and this thing really just speaks.
I think without hearings is better than informally, because it doesn't
'kay.
Tell you what the nature of the resolution is.
Great.
Except that it isn't done by a hearing.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. 2.2.4. The only question I had is, I have no difficulty with the language, and maybe it's a sense of people's general myopia, but the term parties, councils, presiding officers, that includes grievance and respondents. Would you also want to include some reference to relevant other administrators? In other words, if someone files a grievance against the dean or the chair, and the dean or the chair comes and tells me, you know, the world is terrible, and Rivette has filed his 26th grievance, and I said, you know, that's terrible, and I go and do a workshop program, and I say, you know, here's one of the great deficiencies of our procedure, and let me tell you that this guy Smith is
no, that's
you know,
useful
whatever.
Idea.
So,
my point was, we probably still going to need a user's manual.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we need a user's manual that is longer than the procedure.
Yeah, no,
And
I don't dispute
it
at all that.
repeats itself. And one of the things the user's manual does is it has these dozen years of UCFA
Yeah, that
interpretations
needs to get just swept in.
That just needs to disappear.
You need to disappear and you need to extract the principles of the issue.
Right, and one of the principles that's in there was that not just the FDGO need to keep things confidential, everybody else did. And I think three of those interpretations are Michael going to UCFA saying,
yeah,
get these frequent filers to quit talking about this to everybody. I mean, that's my sense of what it reads. So I thought, just spell it out here.
Yeah. No,
was
I think
the
that's
point.
Right. I think that's fine.
But I like your addition of
is,
unrelevant other administrators.
Yeah.
That's useful.
Yeah. Now, the related question in the case of the Andy Hogan sending the email to everyone, I'm on one of those lists. He doesn't know me from Adam. And I say, you know, this is the most god-awful treatment that anyone can ever have, so I send a bunch of emails to my friends in my private mailing list and say, did you get a copy of this, etc., and so on. I don't know what you do about that. This is a person that has no direct involvement in the grievance, but has knowledge of it, because one of the other people on your list already has shared the information about it. And so, maybe. And I don't know what those resolutions say. I don't think they really relate to third parties. They relate to grievance largely, if I recall.
No.
Okay. On page, these are not numbered, but starting with 27 down to 3152. I only had one question. I think the changes you're making are fine, and this may just be my myopia in going through this. 3.1.1 says agreements may be initiated and processed at the college or university level according to the procedures set forth in the document.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find any procedures set forth in the document as I read through it.
Mm.
In other words, if I want to initiate a grievance, how do I do that?
Okay.
Now, does that go back to...
No, I think
one?
That should be clarified. Yeah. I think that should be clarified. Yeah. Now, there's a bigger policy issue in 3.1.1, which... Did I tell you I did have a long conversation
about
your...
about the level.
Deleting department and unit hearings.
Yeah. I think that's fine.
Okay.
I think you'll need to explain why that's being done. And,
okay.
And my advice would be don't fall on your sword on that, because you can continue as you have, which never have them,
just
but the option is there. I mean,
yeah.
But I agree that probably makes sense that based on the experience.
Okay.
Of the
thanks. No, I get your clear.
Yeah.
It's just saying step forth, it should clarify what, where and what. 3.1.3 was to add the footnote on extensions and just put it in the document, get rid of footnotes.
That makes sense.
Okay.
My only question on 3.1.4 is, do you really want past in front of practices? So I can't grieve a current practice, only a past practice.
No, that's fine with me. I was just bringing in wording that we use in labor relations.
Yeah.
But no.
But, you know, if everyone is treated currently and you treat me differently, that should be a basis for a grievance, even though
I agree.
It's not old and outmoded.
I agree.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I didn't have anything on the next page until down to 3.2.2.
Okay, I got a couple to ask you about.
But you may want to ask me. Do you want me to just say that and then come back to
it? Sure. Go ahead.
This is language stuff. I said something like this might be more useful, 3.2.2, within a 90-day period following the filing of the grievance.
Okay.
And again, I would go back to the language earlier. We talked about the FDA determines that the grievance cannot be resolved without a hearing. because again, you don't want to get stuck with informal or formal resolution.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Now yours.
Okay. Earlier. 3156 just uses the word redress. Should there be guidelines? I mean, is that a user manual, or should there be any phrase here that clarifies what this means?
Well, the issue that's really been raised in some cases is whether the redress sought is appropriate. And the one that comes up from time to time is the apology.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And
it seems to me that there may be some user manual language that's
okay.
relevant
okay.
in terms of that.
Okay.
Does the language in the appropriate unit of the university apply to university policies and procedures, or is that written? Does it relate only to subunits? That would be the ambiguity in my mind looking at it. And then the related question is, what is the definition of appropriate? Is this the unit in which the individual is appointed, who pursues the grievance?
Okay.
I don't know. It's a complicated issue because there are things that are general and collegiate and departmental.
Yeah. In terms of numbers, there's two things sort of going on here. Some is that some of the numbers to me were just too short or too difficult to be kept. And so I've made some suggestions, and Terry, Donna, and Christine have agreed or disagreed, and I'll get to those as we do it. The second issue is, in the end, I want some simple way for the FGO and the FGO secretary that it's either 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, meaning we'd say 7, 14, 21 days, or we do 10, 20, 30 days. Something that kind of is a regular pattern, so you don't get yourself lost on which is this one kind of thing. So,
no, I agree with the dates.
So there isn't agreement among us all on the exact dates, but they all agree.
Isn't there
that
a definition that talks about it? Days mean?
Days are calendar
days.
No, but I'm just saying the practicality is when a procedure has such a variety of days, it's just.
Oh, I understand.
It just,
so within 10 days you must do this.
It would just be nice, some clarity. But there is an agreement on all of mine. So, for example, in 318, I've suggested it go from 7 to 10. And everybody thought that's fine. In 319, I suggested go from 5 to 30, and there isn't agreement yet on whether 30 is a good choice or 14 or 20 or 21 would be a better choice, but there is agreement that 5 is too short. Because
yeah. No, I understand that the arguments on both sides is, you know, is it fair to the grievant to sort of require such a long block of time? Well, on the other side of the coin, you can't do it within 5 days, because then you immediately torpedo the hearing because someone says, oh, yeah, that was never raised before.
Right. So we haven't exactly, but there is agreement that some of these, and I guess my question to you would be, is your sense that any of these original days that I'm now proposing amending, that there's anything magical, or they were just compromises at the time?
Compromises are rules of thumb. This is sort of a reasonable sort of.
Okay. Can I ask a side question then?
Yeah.
Why in 35 years didn't anybody say, why don't we change some of these days? Because
I think it was largely a function of the people who served in the capacity of FGO prior to Mike Rubner. The tenures were so short that people sort of got in and got involved and learned all these things. And
mm-hmm.
said, well, if I was going to stay, I would certainly propose X or Y, but I then moved on or were asked to move on.
Okay.
I'm
just curious.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
I'm just curious. Cause
whether that's true or not. And I think Michael had a number of broader issues this is going to be terribly complicated to explain. You're going to have to write an three-page statement that says, what are you really trying to address here? And people will not read, you know, the red language versus the black language and so on.
Good
interesting
point.
Question on 3.2. Is there any merit in talking about changing the heading to that and the language in it, which says resolution without without formal hearing?
I was making a note on your last point. Where are you at now?
3.2, it has informal resolution. It has the same difficulty that I was talking about before.
Resolution without hearing?
Yeah, resolution without hearing, and then change the first sentence. Make every reasonable effort to resolve the matter without a hearing. Now, you know, that's not the end of the world. I mean, I think if you end up with informally, it's sort of picking nits and so
on. But, no, I absolutely like your point, because it's always bothered me that we call them informal hearings, and sometimes there are, I don't know, the longest one I had was 14 points or something. It was several pages of very legalistic language that everybody was signing off to solve a grievance or a set of grievances.
And so
it's not very informal at all.
That's really
it's terribly
point.
Formal.
The point.
Right.
And then
so.
You're going to get someone says, well, you know, Rivette is orchestrating. He shouldn't be doing it. This isn't informal.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I agree.
Right.
So.
The days thing you just have to work out.
Okay.
I didn't have anything on the next page.
Donna caught the, if I'm getting rid of department, I need to get rid of it in 3.3,
right.
3.3.1,
no, probably true.
Et cetera. She
thank
caught
God
us.
Thank God for Donna, who reads these things carefully. She would catch me all the time.
She caught a number of things.
There
are just a set of things about, like I suggested, changing something to 14 days and the three people I've mentioned have said, well, do you want that really, or is 2021 make more sense? So we've got those several places.
Go back to the mode about variation. Do you think you can come reasonably close to have a similar time limit for everything?
No, it's just that I don't want to have 20 and 21, or...
Yeah, no, I understand.
So I'd like them to be 10, 20, 30, or 7, 14, 21, some consistency. No. Oh, we did skip one, which I had talked to you about before, and I came up with this compromise, and I'm still not, I guess you and I have talked about it a couple of times, and that's the standing appeals panel business way back in 3.1.7.
Okay.
So I've suggested that what should be added is the FGO write comments after seeing both parties give more explanation about this stuff.
As an information.
Right. It's not a decision. The FGO's made a decision, right or wrong. Now he's commenting or she's commenting on it.
Yeah. I think the critical question is whether, because as written, I think it's implied that only if the matter is appealed would you write the statement.
Correct.
And the question is whether you would include the commentary in the decision rather than the you know, the Rudner yes, no, no, yes, yes to the five questions. It seems to me. I understand why you want to escape from a lot of work, but it seems to me if issues are, you know, largely straightforward, you've breathed against the wrong person.
I mean, yeah.
It takes a sentence to say.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, one of the things that got funny about this was talking, as you know, I'm going back and doing these interviews with people. I didn't understand and realize till talking to Les Hyman, that's
right.
His name.
Yeah.
That this didn't even exist.
Oh, yeah.
And then Bruce, it didn't even exist. This came just during Michael's time
oh, yeah.
in the 70s, in
Michael,
the 90s.
Michael became very frustrated because he felt very strongly that there were, you know, there were some problems in this respect.
Yeah.
You know, if I showed up as a retired faculty member, then I wasn't eligible or an adjunct.
Mm-hmm.
Those were straightforward, but there were a set of other things.
Yeah.
And, he sort of argued strongly, one needs
a standing,
you know,
appeals
set of
panel.
Expectation. No, he didn't argue for a standing appeals panel.
Oh.
He wanted A, but not B. And
oh.
The UCFA said, well, supposing people disagree with your interpretation, we need some mechanism
uh-huh.
to do that. And that was the history of the appeal.
So ACFA came up with this idea
yeah.
of the standing appeals panel.
One nit,
yeah.
If you look at 317, in the event of any jurisdictional appeal, I don't know what the language is, but it's really the jurisdictional appeal by the FGO, not any jurisdictional appeal. In other words, the role of the standing appeals panel is to only respond
to 3.16,
the point above. Yes, to 3.16. So my concern is any jurisdictional appeal.
How about take out any and just make it A? Would that help?
Yeah, and I think they are.
Thank you.
They are linked enough, so that's not a problem.
Okay. Back where we were.
Yeah.
The next one to ask you about then is 523, which is another kind of policy history one that you could be helpful to. 523.
Oh, yeah. Appeals panel has a finance set branch of my law and unused appeals panel.
You may want to look at the original.
Is board a new name for this? Is that why it's been inserted?
No. Here's 523 as it exists.
Right, okay. All right. Period. For grievances concerning non-reappointment of faculty in the tenure system. Panel shall consist of 5 members, of whom 3 are tenured and 2 are non-tenured. And of this total, 2 are current UCFT members.
Now, the current procedure is that 3 be UCFT.
Oh, I see.
I'm suggesting drop at 1 because of the problem I had where we had 3 appeals in 1 semester.
I think that's fine. You may get some flack on it, but I doubt it.
But I would give too much flack to totally delete them, right?
Probably.
And it would be maybe a foolish idea.
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I would suggest that before 4 grievances, I would put however 4 grievances concerning.
Okay.
Because that's a qualifier to the general sentence.
Again, this was a compromise that came into existence.
I mean, I don't know. It's something worth talking with the tenure committee about. Because I know from recent experience sitting with them, and the chair would say, well, I have this letter from John Rivette that says we need, and someone says, why the hell are we picking panel members? And it's the language of the original procedures compromise.
And there it is there.
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's that's the way of, whether less talked about it or not historically.
Should we just delete them? Just eliminate UCFT special?
I don't think that people sitting on the tenure committee have any particular expertise in making judgments about whether policies, practices, and procedures are fairly applied as distinct from someone who's not set on the UCFT, because what you're drawing on is your knowledge of university, college, departmental policy, and your own experience as a faculty member. But, you might want to test the water with some subset of people on the tenure committee. But I would favor just making it simple.
Thank you.
But, and I think the part is the philosophic argument I've rested. Made, and the other issue is that you're really dealing with a much smaller pool of people.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes it harder to convene a panel, which then works to the disadvantage of everyone involved in the process.
Well, that's why.
Yeah.
When we had 3 in 1 semester, yeah. six months, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I would start with deletion and then use this as a
fallback.
That's
Thank
what
you.
I would do.
Thank
but,
you.
You know, for whatever use that.
That's helpful. 525, it was the same thing of taking something and from the user's manual and bringing it in here.
Yeah,
so the addition was that we did that 2 years ago.
I didn't have anything on the next page.
We got a big, there is an agreement yet on the 533 business.
And what is the language at play?
533?
Yeah, but what was
it? Oh, it's. It was a case that I had about 2 years ago where person filed a grievance. They had an outcome in a hearing that wasn't what they wanted, but the respondent brought in information in that process at the beginning of a hearing where we allow the parties to bring in additional documents if the other doesn't mind, and then if the panel says fine. So a couple additional documents were brought in. And so then the grievant lost, the provost disagreed with the grievant, and so the grievant then got a different counsel, and the different counsel said, what they brought in is these other documents are very important, and you really should go ask Gravett to get you a bunch more information about these things. And so when those information requests were made, the respondent then said, no, I'm not providing that information. We ended up going to hearing and fighting the same thing out there. And the general counsel representative supported the respondent in this, on the argument that appeals can only be exactly the documents and only the things that were raised in the original hearing, that there can, there really cannot be different things. And if you look at the user's manual on this, those are the words as it appears now and as it, I think, has appeared. The user's manual, Michael wrote quite differently, different kind of advice, which was they're not intended to rehash grounds. As a matter of general practice, new information may be submitted only if it's relevant to the appeal and previously unavailable. He goes on and then says, notwithstanding the above, on case-by-case basis, an appeal panel may consider new information or new evidence. And so it was very different than this notion of kind of a traditional court appeals proceeding. And so we do need some clarity on what is it and what is appropriate.
Well, it seems to me several points. One, you don't want a mode in which you essentially turn an appeal process into a totally new hearing.
Right.
And so that you have some language that says, you know, that this is not to be an expected and usual practice. It seems to me you could have a provision that says that additional information wish to be submitted by either party could be done so on a mutually agreeable basis, and that the panel could then decide if such agreement could not be reached in advance of the hearing, to decide whether they want to receive and consider that information.
Which would be what Michael wrote in the user's manual.
That's not, I mean, Michael's thing here and there, and it's not a model of clarity. But I mean, I think that's really the perspective.
Yeah.
I understand the argument on the other side, but the fundamental question is this isn't a court procedure.
And absolutely.
And there may be gaps of knowledge in it. Is this the infamous psychiatry case you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
Where they had this terrible row about bylaws, which and the chair refused to provide it?
Yeah.
Everyone had got it 5 years ago, been distributed to every member of the faculty. And if the faculty member had gone to the chair and said, Charlie, I've lost my copy of the bylaw, would you give? Oh, sure, here, have a copy. I mean, it was...
But it wasn't allowed in the appeal hearing.
Well, the person in the general counsel's wasn't aware of the nature and character of the document, I guess. That was one of the elements.
They probably made mistakes.
Yeah.
It wasn't somebody who normally gets involved in this process. Anyway, so that was discussed.
One of the questions that you might be asked by people in thinking about this, because I think there is a legitimate concern not to have these appeals be converted into full-blown hearings.
Yeah.
If you look historically in cases of hearings for which there were appeals, to what extent does this occur? And, you know, is this normal? Is this sort of occurs with some frequency? Is this very unusual?
I mean, we don't have many. The end here is six hearings a year or something on average, and the end for appeals then drops to about two. So it's a total end of even 35 years is fairly insignificant in a statistic.
In terms of actual appeals.
Right. But my personal experience as FGO and as counsel before is that always the party who loses going to try to look at it, spin it a little differently. And most of the appeals are by grievance, then called appellants. If they convince the original panel that they were right, but the provost said differently, then their argument is fundamentally the provost doesn't know what the provost is talking about, because here's all the evidence, and it was presented, and the panel got it. And that really isn't a new hearing. If, on the other hand, the original panel went against them, and the provost said, I agree with this panel, then they're stuck trying to argue that they presented all this evidence, but nobody got it. And then the truth is, well, of course they're going to be repeating themselves, because they're going to, much of their argument is to say, this is what happened, this is what happened, and it's
if
a real...
You do have language that says, upon the arguments of the parties presented to the appeals panel, and inevitably you've got to refer back to the record of the original hearing, and so I don't think you're going to...
I don't think there's going to be any... I would agree with you. I think this is not meant to be a court of law. It's an informal internal process.
How do the lawyers deal with the smoking gun problem? The letter that's written that no one knew about, that animated, and you know, the chair wrote a letter to the dean saying, you know, this son of a bitch, we're gonna, you know, tack his hide to the wall, and that was not available to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly not part of the original record.
There is procedure for the president to send things back to the original panel.
How does the president know that the letter exists?
True.
Yeah.
It'd only come up by another hearing.
So I think you need to get some cleanup of the Rudner swings and roundabouts language, right?
Okay.
To be able to get that.
Donna caught in six that, again, I forgot to delete department unit several times.
Right.
Okay.
I had nothing on the next page.
Okay. Just dates, and as I said, there isn't agreement yet on what... There's agreement that 72 hours is ridiculous. I've proposed 10 days, and again, I don't know where 72 hours came from.
Now, going back to what I said earlier, the
where are you?
Said the procedures shall be initiated relative to procedures in this document.
Mm-hmm.
You might just want to cite...
this
six certainly for one in terms of hearings, and you might want to cite section one that talks about the need for a written grievance with the allegation and so on.
Okay, that's helpful. One, I don't know where you're at now, but
I'm on the page that starts with 614 and goes to 616, and I have no questions for that.
Okay.
Did you have any?
There was thought that that moving it from 14 to 30 might be too much, maybe 20 or 21 on one of the date changes. But 6-3, there was agreement that the 72 hours was a mistake and that 10 days was probably a more reasonable amount.
This is 616, 6-1-16, 30 days replacing 14.
That was one where Terry or Donna's response was maybe 20 or 21.
Yeah, I think there's concern. I don't know, again, what the record is, and again, you don't have a large number of cases, but my experience is in many instances, maybe almost all, but certainly a very large fraction, the FGO gives the panel more time.
Right, and so should it just be giving them more time from the start?
Yeah.
I mean, that was, and then the same thing.
The argument on the other side is that if you give them 30 days, they're going to take 30 days, and everyone is sort of sitting and wondering.
Yeah.
So there may be some merit of 20 days with opportunities for extension.
That's kind of where we ended up with the conversation. I wanted to ask you, in 6-3, the original is 72 hours, and I'm proposing make it 10 days. 72 hours is one of the things in the original 71 document. Do you know where that came from, that somebody thought 72 hours was a...
I can't argue where 72 came from. And again, I wasn't involved in
earlier
discussions, but I think the kind of philosophy was that you wanted it, this was a provision to assist the grievant, to give them the maximum amount of time to get the information to prepare their case. I don't know to what extent practically that creates a problem.
The 72 hours creates a problem because
it means that you've got a panel meeting scheduled, and then folks say, well, gee, how can I respond to all of this stuff?
Well, the places where 72 hours is where we deliver things, and what it means is if the hearing's Monday morning, we're delivering it to you Thursday and or Friday, and people aren't reading stuff, and or there's no way to respond, so it just seemed too quick. But I was curious. I mean, 72 is what it says in the 71 document.
No, I think that's the theory.
So it didn't make much sense.
Hyman probably has some perspective, and maybe not. Maybe in the dimness of time.
I don't think I caught the 72 hours with him. In 8.2 and 8.3, the word elected shouldn't be in there. I guess that, again, is a historic term.
Yeah, oh, that's right. That just gets modified.
Right.
Correction.
And
so in 8.3.
Yeah, right. And just get rid of department unit a couple more places. And like I said, condense the appendices and reword them. They're kind of redundant on themselves.
The last page, the boxes.
Because I moved the dates, I moved all that stuff into the text. I think.
So the last one, the academic hiring procedures applicable shall apply to the appointment of the FGO, appears somewhere in the appendix.
It needs to.
Yeah. And there was a footnote about it. Any time limit specified may be waived or extended.
That I put into the text itself.
And that's under the role of what? Not.
That's right. In 3.
Before the FGO, it's earlier on. Yeah.
It's in.
And the appendix for the appointment.
313.
That gets deleted. Could you put it all in the text?
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Let me move this back. This is yours.
So maybe we can meet again another time and talk about some other things.
Yeah.
Thanks.